Today is Sunday, February 6th, 2022. This is part 27 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart. Last name spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Tom. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, you too. Glad to hear it. And may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you. The last interview, we left off in 2009. What happened in 2010?
Yeah, you know, I don't recall the circumstances in my personal life that resulted in us dropping long trips for a couple of years, but that's what the record shows, and I think it was probably a combination of work and family issues, right? But in any event, in 2010, basically, I did some short hikes with Art, fairly memorable hikes. I certainly want to clarify that. But and the first of these was in April, and so we went. We actually took gear for multiple nights to the South Rim. With the objective of trying to bag some summits like Espeo, Wallace, Marsh Butte, and et cetera, and Geikie. Fairly straightforward summits that you can tackle from the South Rim. And, of course, it's a little warm in April even, and particularly for a Canadian guy coming down. Mm-hmm. So, nonetheless, we got our gear together and drove up to Desert View area. And the first attempt that we were going to try was to get out to Espeo. Now, I read Harvey's notes about climbing this from, when I was a youngster. And it was a summit that I always wanted to get onto because it's quite remote, right?
Right.
You have to walk quite a ways north there along the Palisades of the desert. And I always figured it would probably have a tremendous view, too, mm-hmm. which it does. But,
yes.
Of course, any place along the Palisades of the desert has a tremendous view. And I found that out, when I did the hike with Renee, when we went from Comanche Point out to almost to Cape Solitude. It's just one fantastic view after another. So
right.
Art and I, anyways, got his Impreza, and we drove up, and the first place we went and parked at Desert View, and then hiked down the road there, past the watchtower, and then dropped down to the area at the head of the old Tanner Trail in the arm of Tanner Creek that's east of Desert View.
Right.
And so we poked around there, and Art had been down that trail at one point when he was doing his Red Wall walking. So he showed me where he started down and kind of filed it away for future reference. Myself, and then we kept walking out, followed the road out, and the plan was to hike out to Espeo and camp there, and then try the summit the next day. So it was a fairly straightforward walk out the road, and just before the Jeep trail there drops down towards the old park boundary.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's still the current park boundary.
Right.
Just east of Espeo, we actually headed west and continued along this north-south valley that parallels the rim about half a mile to the east of the Palisades of the Desert. And then when we got down to within pretty much due east of Espeo, then we worked our way back up towards the Palisades south of Espeo and to the notch there, and then hiked up to the top of the ridge that is just right there at Espeo. And we'd gotten some beta. We were talking about beta earlier, but we'd gotten some information from Jim Ullman about where the start of the route might be.
Okay.
And, of course, we had Harvey's notes, but they weren't that accurate or precise. So, and partly, we kind of like to explore and find our way,
mm-hmm.
on our own.
Yeah.
So, too much information sometimes is a bad thing. But In any event, the idea was to drop down the next day to go to do Cheops, and so we found a nice campsite there right on this point. I'm sorry, not Cheops, but Espejo.
Right.
We got on, we found this nice campsite there under Pinion, and we went and explored the top of the descent to try and find where we, you know, would drop down in the morning. And it wasn't at all obvious, except that because it's incredibly steep in there, you know, it's very, I don't know if you've done that climb, but it's, you're dropping down from the rim of the Palisades of the desert, and it's all very, very steep, because in much of the Palisades, you know, you've got to drop from the rim down to the Supai. It's just a vertical drop. So,
yes.
You know, the area in vicinity of Espejo is quite steep, and it took us a little bit of time because it wasn't cairned, but with Jim Ullman's suggestion that the descent gully would be just north of an east-west line that goes from Espejo to the high point of the rim, just to the east of Espejo,
right.
we figured out, you know, what looked like a reasonable descent gully. And there's a nice limestone pinnacle in there about 40 feet down, and that's kind of, you know, readily identifiable. So we felt good to go for the morning, and walked back to our packs, and then had our dinner there and relaxed in the evening sun, and finally went to bed. So the next morning we get up and we start down, and I have to tell you, this was one of the more complex routes that we've worked on over the years, and not having detailed information made it a lot more fun. But quite honestly, at one point we were pretty much ready to call it quits. So you work your way down through the Kaibab, and basically some vertical chutes, chimneys and gullies, really steep gullies, past chalk stones and whatnot, and then you get to these short terraces, and you can walk along the terrace, laterally for a little ways to try and find another connecting gully. And you do this for several levels. And we got down pretty far into the Coconino, I believe it was, and the upper part of the Coconino. And we're looking about to find the way down. And it was quite challenging. Actually, this was still in the Kaibab now that I'm thinking about the topography here. And so we actually looked into a couple of shorter gullies. You know, there's still a 30-foot drop down to the next terrace, and we couldn't find any way through. So then we walked like 100 meters to the northeast to where we thought we could see a talus cone coming up and connecting with our terrace level. But it wasn't. It was short of the ledge we were on. So at that point, we basically said, looks like it might not happen. And we walked back, and, you know, serendipitously, I said, well, look, I'm just going to take a little look down the first gully that we had dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started down, and there was the big chalk stone, and I felt like I could kind of maybe work my way around the east side of this chalk stone. But as I was down at kind of near the bottom of it, I could look across to the other side and see very obvious broken ledges. So I called up to Art, and he came scrambling down the west side of this chalk stone, and voila, it was straightforward, right?
Yeah.
And we got down to the next terrace, and so it was just a lot of back and forth negotiating, you know, with gullies and poking about, and it takes time to do that, but it's pretty satisfying when you finally put it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing to note is that there's scat. There were deer and sheep scat all along this route. So, you know, we weren't doing anything that the four-legged creatures can't surmount. It's kind of hard to believe that sometimes, but obviously these animals can jump quite effectively, you know, up short cliffs and whatnot, and work their way up fairly small ledges. I think if you've ever seen bighorn, say, in the inner gorge, clambering up some of the slopes that they go up, you can see that they can negotiate very, very small ledges if they need to.
Right.
And whether they're fearless or not, we don't know. But
there's a route there down through the red wall, isn't there?
Well, that's a very good question. I have always wondered that, and it's on my list to go check that out.
Okay.
So if you're in, now, you know there's a route from Comanche Point down.
Maybe that's the one I'm thinking of.
Okay, that's a, yeah, that's a Ken Walters and Harvey Butchert route.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I guess Ken Walters pioneered that with Harvey, and Ken, you know, Ken, it's pretty risky from what I understand. I actually came up from below in the 90s, I guess, on one of my trips with Bruce, and I could see the talus cone that one has to climb up. That the talus cone is through much of the red wall, and it looked frightening. You know, this vertical quaternary conglomerate that's all stacked up on top. But Ken and Harvey apparently figured out a route down that. Now, having said that, that's coming down Comanche Creek drainage,
right,
so that's a couple miles south of Espeo.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I have noticed that it looks to me like there's a the slope, the red wall slope south of Espeo is potentially workable as well. And so I've always wanted to go back there and see if that could be pieced together.
Right.
I don't know. We'll have to see.
I just don't remember climbing a Espeo to be that difficult. I mean, it was just, I was as lucky as stumbled into this chute, and down the chute went, and got us down a little over cross you go, and back up, and then go back down and up, and that was that. But yeah, there was a lot of signs of animal there, and I was like, where are they going? What are they doing? How are they doing this?
Yeah.
Where do they go from here if they're going down? So
yeah,
another mystery.
Yeah, I know, and you know, quite often when you see that sign, you know you need to keep persisting, right? Because
right. The
route's got to be around somewhere.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Which is that's a fortunate thing to see. Now there are times when you don't see any sign, and you know that it's a fairly
lonely. I don't like
a dicey route.
I don't like
that. Yeah, exactly. But I think it also goes to show you how sometimes, you know, the route finding is bang on, and sometimes you have to work harder for it, right? And like I've done certain hikes, routes myself, where I came back 10, 15, 20 years later, and it was a piece of cake the second time, or it was a lot harder, you know? And the question is, well, were you exactly on route, or,
right.
you know, if you were, maybe it was just your psychological status that day.
That's right.
Right?
So, that's right.
Yeah. Anyways, we made it down finally, and it's a neat little walk, as you mentioned, out to the summit there. Lots of slippery, sloping sandstone slabs, and
it's very
I remember
airy.
You had to.
Yeah.
Yes, you had to be very careful poking around to make sure that big things didn't start sliding away, right? And we got out there, and there were a number of comments in the register. I think Aaron Tomasi had signed in, and there was a Mickey's Big Mouth bottle cap, which I think is George Bain's.
The Gore-Tex brothers.
Yeah, and so we figured we had the fourth or fifth assignment, something like that.
Cool.
For some reason, I think that Tomasi had done it twice before we got there, but in any event, it was. I thought it would be much more visited summit, and maybe it is. Maybe people just don't sign into the register.
Maybe.
So, anyways, really, really fun hike. And so we started back up in the afternoon, and you know, it's a fairly straightforward hike to go down from the rim back down to the Jeep trail there, and then we followed that back. So our plan was actually to go back up to the rim and then head to the west to do, we wanted to hike up Berry Butte the next day. But we got to, we got back on the road there to where the Jeep Trail meets the road that comes down from Desert View,
right,
just west of Cedar Mountain. And we just figured we were feeling pretty tired, so let's just relax there in the Pinyon Juniper Forest, right? It's really pretty in that area. There's lots of First Nations, pottery shards and whatnot to look at. And so we camped there, and then in the morning got up early and hiked back up. So to the vehicle there parked near Desert View. And so, like I say, the next day, that day, the plan was to try and get out to Berry Butte. So we worked our way over to the Grandview Trail head parking area and left the car there and started down the trail to the there's a series of notches that the trail goes through as it heads down towards Horseshoe Mesa.
Right.
And at the first one, there's a in the Coconino, you can continue to the north. The trail takes a turn to the east from that notch and heads down towards to the east along the ridge and then drops down through the Supai. But we continued north down this ridge, and if you follow out this ridge, there's a really nice and elegant Coconino Butte that sits out to the north end of this ridge. And quite honestly, I don't understand why Berry Butte was appended to the butte that is actually called that, because this butte, this Coconino Butte that sits up there right out on this ridge, kind of overlooks the whole Horseshoe Mesa area.
Oh, wow.
And to me, it would be a much more, useful memorial to Bill Berry or whatever. But any event, Berry Butte is a very a low Supai Butte farther out the ridge to the north west.
All right.
And so I had gone up this unnamed Coconino Butte in 93, I think it was, just on a day hike. So we followed that, start of that route. But then eventually we dropped down to the Red Wall Rim. Not to the rim, but in the lower part of the Supai, heading out to the saddle by Berry Butte. And so again, we had some information from Jim Ullman, because he had done the first ascent of Berry Butte with a group from, I think it was a Grand Canyon Historical Society outing.
Oh, cool.
And like 10 or 12 people he took down there on this trip. And so we followed this ridge out to Berry Butte, and we got to the butte, and at the east end of the butte, southeast end of the butte, there's a very interesting notch that kind of goes right through the ridge. And it kind of forms chimneys on either side. You can see through this notch, right, from one side of the butte to the other, one side of the ridge to the other. And so Jim had told us that his route went up this chimney on the north side of this east-west ridge on the east end of Berry. And so we looked at this, and we actually tried to get into it, but it was really kind of challenging without a rope or anything like that. And I was just couldn't believe that he brought 10, 12 people up that. Mm. I suppose with a rope, it might have been easier, but, you could haul people. And I think some of these people weren't even climbers. So whether we had the wrong route or what, I don't know. But what, we poked around with this because we thought that was the route. And again, we're thinking, oh, man, I guess we're going to have to back off this one, So we actually said, okay, we're not going to get up this today. And I said, well, look, before we finish here, let's just walk around the summit block and see what we can see, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so so we were walking along the north side of the butte, and we got split up because I remember that I stopped at this gully. I thought maybe it would go, right? But I said, well, I think what I'll do is I'll continue around to the west end and see if there's something even better, right?
Yeah.
And so I did that. I went around the west end of the butte and then actually continued around to the south side and walked along that a little bit. But, of course, it's all very steep Supai. So I went back, and by this time Art had come along and to this place, this gully, and I said, why don't we give this a try? And it turned out to be so easy. It was a piece of cake.
Cool.
I mean, you had to be ginger, right?
Yeah.
You had to be careful.
Yeah,
and there was some loose stuff in it, but I don't know whether that was, Jim's actual route or what. But he very distinctly had talked about this this notch in the east end of the ridge where you could, the sun would actually shine through it. So, in any event, we got a fairly easy route up Berry Butte, and I think Barry at that time hadn't, it had just been formally named, or well, maybe within the previous 10 years, something like that. So it was, you know, again, it was a second summit in 2 days, which is pretty good for Grand Canyon standards. Uh-huh. So I was pretty happy to get that, right? And so in actuality, we had planned, you know, we had time and we had brought supplies up to do to try to do Wallace Butte again.
Okay.
And but we were feeling the heat from these two outings, and I hadn't actually finished the Berry Butte thing hike, because after we did the ascent, we actually dropped down to the rim of the Red Wall and followed that around to join up with the Grandview Trail at the head of Cottonwood Canyon. And there's a lot of mining junk all in that area.
Huh.
And, you know, oh, yeah, there's certainly, you know, the claims on and workings on Horseshoe Mesa are fairly extensive.
Right.
But there's also a lot of exploration material and junk everywhere in the Cottonwood drainage. Mm-hmm. And Art told me he found a potbelly stove on the Red Wall Rim just east of Berry Butte, although we didn't see it on this trip.
Huh.
And I'd found mule shoes on the Red Wall farther to the north from Berry Butte when I'd been down there a number of years earlier. So, yeah, you a lot of evidence of the miners in that whole area, and checking out, you know, trying to find new prospects and improve the workings. So it was a fun day, but fairly tiring.
Yes.
And so at that point, we decided, I think Wallace Butte is going to be out, because it's a long way out to Bass Trailhead, and then, you know, you got to walk fairly, you know, it's a long trip to do the climb. And, you know, we hadn't been successful on Wallace on a couple of occasions in the past, so we decided to bag that. And I said to Art, I remember that Harvey talked about this ponderosa pine below the rim of the Tapetes, somewhere between Garden Creek and Horn Creek. I said, why don't we try and find that, right? That'd be a fun day trip. And so he agreed that would be a nice objective. So because we were feeling so beat after Berry Butte, you know, the plan was going to be that we would camp in the forest somewhere. But I told Art, I said, look, I really want to go into Tucson and get a good meal before we go camp out. And he said, well, why don't we just go into Tucson and get a hotel? And
Art's a smart guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a smart guy. And you know, quite honestly, at that point, that was a turning point, because before that, we kind of never went to the hotels, right? We never went to hotels. But after that, we started hitting them more frequently. So, especially at the end of a longer trip, right? You know, it's sometimes it's just get a hotel room instead of trying to drive down to Phoenix at 2 a.m.
Right.
So, anyways, we got a hotel room in Tucson and had a nice meal there, and we're all freshened up for heading down to the Ponderosa Pine. And so this is such a neat place to get to. It's very easy, because we just followed the Bright Angel trail down to Plateau Point.
Right.
And I hadn't been there since like 1999. I did a day hike with Renee down there. Art said he hadn't been there for 45 years.
Oh wow!
So in the you know, this would be in the I guess late 60s or 70s when he was down there. So it was kind of reminiscing for both of us. And from Plateau Point, then we walked the Tapetes Rim to the west, and eventually you come to a fairly distinct drainage, and you can actually work your way down through some notches in the Tapetes. Really kind of neat scrambling, and you get your way down to the base of the Tapetes. And it's kind of an imposing wall there, and so you start walking along the base of this Tapetes wall to the north. You go around a ridge, and it's quite steep. And it's when we got to the ridge, we could look to the southwest, and we could see this pine tree. And So we worked our way over to the pond, and it's very luxuriant grass all on the slope around this pine tree. But unfortunately, the pine itself was like 95% dead.
Oh, wow.
And I think from what I described, you know, the way it was described in Harvey's notes from many, many years before in the 60s, there was much more growth, live growth on the tree at that point. And I don't know what it's like now because it's, 12 years later or 10 years later. But there was a little bit of live growth on the tree. And there was another, there was a pinyon pine. This was a ponderosa pine, right?
Not
a pinyon, but this, it's a ponderosa, maybe 80 feet high, right?
Right.
And next to it, there was a pinyon starting to come up. So hopefully there's a successor to the ponderosa, if indeed it has completely died since that time. I don't know of anybody who's been down there who could comment on that. So it'd be a nice day hike if you're ever up at the South Rim with looking for something to do.
You know, every time we go by on the river, I always look for that ponderosa. I haven't gone through or I haven't seen it. And the last time would have just been a year ago. And it seemed to be there and seemed to be doing pretty good. So I wonder I wonder if there's a couple of them. I wonder if there's two of them.
Well, it could be. I mean, maybe you should carefully plot where yours is or the one you've seen that looks really good. And because I can send you the coordinates of you know, where this dead one was. And it's very interesting because the Tapiz Cliff there is very sheer.
Right.
But there's a drainage up just directly above this ponderosa pine where...
You mean to the east, you know, or you mean directly like up over the top of it?
Directly above it, above the pine on the cliff.
Because the one we see from the river,
would be coming off the
drainage is just to the east of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, when I say drainage, I mean just like a little gully in the Tapiz.
Yeah, like
it's just a little tiny. It's not like a any sort of a substantial valley.
That's right.
It's just a little cut in the Tapiz,
that's
but
right.
It definitely funnels water because you can see that it's carved out right where water has kind of poured off over this this little notch, and it's oriented directly down onto the ponderosa pine. So. That explains why there's all that luxuriant grass there,
right?
Because it's it's receiving water every time there's any sort of a heavy rain in there.
And it's north facing, so it doesn't have the sun beating down on it,
right?
And
right.
So any water it does get, it hangs on to pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. It would be really neat to see if I'd love to get back down there and see if that thing is still there. And I'd love if you can confirm that it's doing better, that would be great, because it looked like it was on its last legs when we saw it. So, but I guess there was some good moisture in those years around 2010. So 11 and whatnot. So maybe it revitalized itself. I don't know. So
curious.
So that was a nice way to spend the day. I remember coming up from Bright Angel Gardens and. Indian Gardens, I'm sorry, and moving quite quickly on that hike. So that was kind of nice after the two previous days when we were feeling the heat. So so that was those were three hikes in a row there that were quite fun. Didn't get to do all the summits we had hoped, but we still got a couple. And I actually had a conference in Phoenix. A geological conference in the later part of April, the same year. So I'm sorry, I'm getting that mixed up. It was a couple of years later in 2012. So again, I don't know why there were no hikes in 2011, but it wasn't until April of 2012 when I had a geological conference in Phoenix, and that brought me down there. And Art and I had planned to do a fairly good trip in the Bright Angel area. We wanted to do the ascents of Manu and Clement Powell and Hillers and Shellback Butte, and you know, that complex there, which I call the Buddha complex, lots of summits. And So we actually had all our gear packed, and we started down the South Kaibab Trail. This would be in late April of 2012. And by the time we got down to the Red Wall, the base of the Red Wall, I was feeling really fatigued. And, I mean, unusually so. I talk about fatigue on these trips, and it's the kind of thing where, you know, you lie down in the shade and, you know, 5 minutes later you're feeling okay. You have your energy back. But this thing was something different. And you know, there's not much shade in that, along the Kaibab, South Kaibab there, when you're going through the Moab, there's some little gullies and whatnot that you can. And so I laid down, and I just felt so bad, and I actually fell asleep. And Art was very patient, let me nap. And then I came to, and there were some hikers coming down the trail, and probably taking pity on the out of shape hiker, you know. And I remember people giving me some antioxidant pills, and in any event, I just was completely bagged. And I told Art, I just don't think I can continue. I can hardly walk. So we decided to cancel this trip, you know, and just try and get back out of the canyon that day. And which we did, we managed it, but only because Art took a lot of my pack onto his, and, you know, more or less let me walk with minimal weight up through the, up the South Kaibab Trail. I remember at the top of the Red Wall, I crashed out for like an hour and a half.
Wow.
And so I was really feeling something. And I got back to Phoenix at the end of the day, so we finished out. We got to the rim and decided we were done because I was just wasted. And I actually had a really significant flu for like 3 weeks,
oh, wow.
3 or 4 weeks. And it took me that long after returning to Vancouver to finally shake it. And I actually spent 3 days at my mother's house, more or less sleeping it off, you know, after this aborted hike. So, you know, something was there, something hit me really, really solidly. And I don't know what it was, but it certainly, it stopped me dead in my tracks. And kind of, you know, when you're struck down, I think, by something like that, and you feel really vulnerable, right? Like you're sitting down there at the bottom of the base of the Red Wall, thinking, it's 4 miles up to the rim, and I can barely walk,
and it's elevation, you know, on top of being ill, there's just no energy.
Yeah, and so I just don't like feeling that way because. Mm-hmm. Normally I feel like, you know, I may be tired, but I know that with a rest I can accomplish what I have to do, you know. And this was a different situation because it really kicked me down, and I don't know what it was. You know, at times in my career here as a geologist, I've gone to some kind of isolated places in East Asia and whatnot, and I've contracted some illnesses that were never identified, you know. Mm-hmm. The specialists would check me out for tropical medicine, tropical diseases and whatnot, could never really find anything. Mm. But, you know, this was a similar type thing in that it just really took a lot out of me. But anyways, we had to cancel that trip and which, you know, had hoped to get us some longer summits. Yeah, okay, that was April 27th, that ill-fated trip. And I mentioned a few minutes ago that there was a geological conference. And the geological conference was actually a little bit later. It was in June and in Phoenix. And so I came back down to Phoenix in June. So I went back up to Vancouver after this ill-fated experience and recuperated there, and then came down for this geological conference. And Art and I said, well, let's try and do some shorter trips off the North Rim. And this sounded like a great option because, number one, it's hot, and,
right.
and being up on the North Rim would be cooler for us.
Yes.
And and, you know, we could take it easy. And it was going to be day trips, so, you know, you don't get too committed.
Right.
And if something goes haywire, then you're not too far away from getting yourself out. So we had good plans to do a number of summits. And so the first of them that we did, went for was Tritall. And this is very, very close to the rim, right? It's you drive to Roosevelt Point, and it's a Kaibab summit that is just to the northeast of the point.
Where is this?
And
I'm not familiar with this one at all.
What's that?
Tritall.
Tritall. No, it's Tritle.
Okay, I'm not familiar with it at all. Roosevelt Point. Where is this?
So, you know where? Let's see. You know where Atoko Point is? You know where Brady Peak is? Let me give you. I'll move out
yes,
a little bit.
Yes, painful so silence here. I'm like, wait a minute.
Where's
my map? Negwip, got it. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm. You know, I'm looking at my map here, so I'm just making assumptions about where we are. But no, Tritall is in. It's in the southernmost part of the. It's on the divide actually between Nankweep and Quaggan Trail.
Oh, okay.
But
all
it's right off the rim.
Got it.
So you drive there to Roosevelt Point, and Roosevelt's newly named too. That was named about 20 years ago, I think. Vista Encantada is farther to the north along the.
It's supposed to be kind of brushy up there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But in that area, there's a lot of brush. But going out to Tritall is simple, right?
Okay.
I think because a lot of people go out there, and you know, it's so close to the rim road that you're basically out there in 10 minutes, and there's like a deer trail, right, that takes you out there. So, it's a fun little climb, and so we worked our way out, and ironically there's two summits of Tritall. There's an eastern one, which is farther out on the ridge, and then the western one, which is the one that's closest to the rim road. And the western one is actually the higher one. But if you look at the topographic map, the name is placed on the one that's farther east, and even though it's lower. So, you know, I assume this is because when one is looking at it from down in Ankwe Valley, you know, you look up to the southwest and you see Tritall there, and the most imposing part of it is the part that is at the east end of the ridge, right? Even though it's a little bit lower. So, anyways, we decided we were going to go for this summit, and so we drove out there, parked the car at Roosevelt Point, and scrambled out onto the ridge. And there's a beautiful little walk along the north side of that. Western summit, really pretty with the ponderosas in there and the Kaibab limestone cliff rising above you. So we walked along there following the deer trails and got to the notch between the west and the east summits, and then we followed along the south side of Tritall because we weren't sure exactly where the route would be, and the south side of the eastern summit block, and got to the ridge crest then at the east side of the eastern block, and we could see from there the obvious route that goes up a chimney crack system just on the north side of that block. And so we had brought along a small rope, a short rope, and like a 6 mil, and for rappelling, you know, in case we had to. And Art started up this route, and he just scrambled up like a mountain goat,
right,
trailing the rope. And I came up behind him, and I'm glad I had the rope actually, because there's some good exposure. If you if you were to pop off, it would be, you know, kind of nasty. But there's big holes there. It's all quite straightforward. You really wouldn't need a rope at all. So, but we got to the top, and it was one of those summits where there's a cairn but no register, so we just relaxed there for a little while and thought, well, we'll go take a look at the western summit and see what that looks like as well. So we actually had to rig a rappel to get us down that climb, which I'm glad we did that, because that was, you know, going down that climb, it would be a challenge. It's kind of committing. So we got the rappel down, took that down, and then started back towards the western summit. And when we got to back to the saddle that's to the west of that summit, Art said, "I'm not going to go any farther, but you can go take a look at it." So I did. I walked along the ledges along the south side of that west summit, and could see the obvious route. It's a nice open book crack system, and very very big holes and whatnot. But it was, I mean, my understanding at the time was that it was 5.2, right? So a easy fifth class climb. But, you know, you'd want to have protection on it. And we didn't have any gear for protecting. And I was by myself, too. So
right.
I basically said, well, I'm not gonna tackle this now. So I eventually did it later with another fellow, Mark Coleman. We'll talk about that, I guess, at some point. But
okay.
So we just kind of scrambled back up to the rim and, you know, had a nice, relaxing afternoon, a fun little day hike. And then the next day, our plan was to go out to Sieber Point, or Sieber, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but Sieber is, it's on the north side of the Nankui Basin. It's just kind of due south of the Saddle Mountain notch along that ridge,
okay,
where that forms the saddle, and it's basically a summit at the top of the red wall. It's a point, basically.
Oh, okay.
Not much of a summit, but what we did was we went actually into the we drove from Trail back to the village there, and kind of freshened up in the, I think we had a shower and got ourselves a snack there, and then we headed back out of the park to the road that heads towards the Saddle Mountain Trail. Right there's a road that comes down, from about 2 miles north of the park entrance there.
Right,
you turn to the east, and you can follow a nice road that goes essentially along the boundary of the park,
mm-hmm,
and to a trailhead that takes you down to Saddle Mountain.
Yeah,
and so we camped outside the park that night in a nice spot there off this road. And Art had brought along an ice chest with all sorts of, like, Dr. Peppers and orange juice.
Hmm.
And he had these ham sandwiches that he'd made. And it was just so, relaxing, right? To be up on the rim there, and enjoying this luxuriance of cold beverages and cool sandwiches and chips and Tecate beer with limes so it was and he had lounge chairs, right? All this stuff came out of his little embrasa. And we really had a relaxing time there, kind of like a river trip, sounds like.
And the view is stunning from up there.
Oh, well, actually, it is from the end of that road, but where we were in the forest, we just had the Ponderosa, right?
Okay.
But
well, that's
still,
nice.
It's
still,
yeah, and
it
and
beats
quite honestly,
the heat.
It beats the heat for sure. And I quite enjoy that. And I had done some hikes like this in the 70s when I was just getting started in the canyon, I liked ever since then. I've liked the concept of going to the North Rim and just doing day trips off the rim, right?
Yeah.
And coming back to the cool sanctity of the rim forest, where you can relax and it's so peaceful. And then, you know, you do these scrambles during the day that can be pretty demanding and challenging, but you've always got that that opportunity to come back where it's peaceful,
right,
and calm and relaxing. So, you know, I quite enjoy these trips to the North Rim when that's the style, right? Where you're kind of car camping and doing these little jaunts. So,
mm-hmm.
So the trip out to Sieber was, you know, it's a long slog the way we did it. And so in the morning after this wonderful interlude in the forest, we drove out to the end of that road And there were a number of cars there that for people who are presumably hiking down to the Nanquib Trail and then going down to the river, I guess. But we just parked the car there and then started down that trail. And I had been through there on that trail in, I think, around 1977. And actually, at that time, I saw a mountain cat on that trail. And just a flash in the woods, right, in front of my eyes. And I actually lost the trail in 77 because it was so, obscured and basically unmarked. I picked it up farther along, but it just goes to show you back at that time, there was very little traffic, whereas now, or even at this time in 2012, there's a lot of traffic on that route.
Oh, wow.
And it's a very obvious trail, right? And which is good if you're trying to make time, which we were doing, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah, and so we followed the trail down, and it gets down. Eventually, it gets down to the saddle, where the trail goes north down into Saddle Canyon, and of course the Nanquib Trail drops down the south side of that saddle. And so we went down, started down the Nanquib Trail. You go through the upper cliff there, and then there's a route called the Free Fall Route, which then drops right down into the arm of Nanquib Creek that goes down from the saddle. And, you know, we had both done this at different times. I did it in the 70s when I was in there solo and climbed Burke Point and Sieber Point. You know, it's a quick way to get into the upper part of Nanquib,
right,
by bypassing the rest of the Nanquib Trail. And then Art and I and Bruce had gone down there on a longer Nanquib Quaggan trip. So we'd been through there several times, and Art and I just kind of wandered down, and then we followed the Redwall Rim, once we got down to it, to the southeast, out to Sieber. And you're talking about your brush, you know, you mentioned that earlier, and this was pretty intense, scrambling through the brush there on the at the top of the Redwall. So it was pretty tiring and hot, and we finally got out to Sieber there again, which is, it's not much from above. You know, when you're on this so-called summit, it's just a crest on the ridge, basically.
Huh.
And I mean, there's a little bit of height on it, maybe
right.
30 feet or something like that of sandstone. But yeah, not in the Hermit, but not anything substantial. You know, these summits are impressive from below, right?
Right.
When you look up at them. So, and it's called a point. It is a point, right? So it's not, you know, some people would say, well, it doesn't even qualify as a summit.
Right.
But it's a named feature, and
right.
I was interested in getting out there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And, you know, you have fantastic views down into the falls that are in upper arm of Nanquib there below Woolsey Butte.
Okay.
And there's a falls. I'm not sure, you know, if you know about it, but it's just a beautiful waterfall that comes down through the Capiche Cliff. It faces north, and you get a tremendous view of that from Sieber, Sieber Point. So, you know, we got to look at that. And then rather than going back the way we came along the Redwall Rim, we just followed the ridge crest from Sieber Point to the northwest and managed to work our way through the upper Supai Cliffs so that we could follow the Supai Rim rather than the Redwall Rim. And this turned out to be a real key way to go because, you know, in some places there's open slabs of Supai sandstone that you can walk along, and it was much easier going than following the Redwall Rim that we'd done in the morning. So that's the way we went back and intersected the trail then up to the roadhead at a higher point. And it was, again, another fun day and really, but tiring, certainly fatiguing. And so we went back to our campsite, and Art had another one of these meals prepared, and how are we doing on time here, Tom?
Good. We're all right. We're
okay.
We 50 minutes in.
Okay. So the next day we wanted to try and go out to Woolsey Butte.
Okay.
Now, Woolsey is another one of these. It's actually a butte. It's actually got some relief on it, so it's a little bit more so than Cyber. More so of a summit than Cyber.
And how,
but
do,
again,
you,
it's
how,
like,
how do you spell that, Jim?
It's W-O-O-L-S-E-Y.
Thank you.
Yeah. So this is Woolsey Butte is, again, in Nankweep drainage.
Okay.
And it's north of Mount Hayden, about
okay.
a mile.
All right.
Okay, so again, it's another little pile of hermit shale sandstone that sits on top of the red wall. And it's fairly straightforward to get to it if you know the route down from Point Imperial.
Mm.
So if you've gone and climbed Mount Hayden, you know, you've probably, you would have gone down the gullies to the north of Point Imperial. And in the past, when I had gone down there, like when I climbed Hayden with Larry Treber, I think in 75, it was really densely vegetated.
Mm.
And it was hard to, you know, hard to find the route through the Coconino there. But when we went there this time, there'd been a fire in that area.
Ah.
Had gone through Point Imperial area, in the upper part through the Kaibab and Torweep. So there was a lot of burned out brush that wasn't impeding us this time. And we worked our way down fairly quickly, but when we got into the Coconino, the brush had not burned.
Ooh.
And it was really, really slow going. So this gully, this descent gully, is it's just north of Point Imperial. You start at the parking lot there, and you just start heading north, and you work
okay.
your way down the open slopes, and you get into the drainage that it's an east-facing drainage, and you know, it's fairly straightforward. There's some steep chutes and whatnot, but the vegetation makes it all fairly easy. But of course, it's very rough going in that vegetation.
Yes.
So, and we got down, and then we're below the Coconino finally, and we had to traverse the Supai, and this is all in the sun, and it was just chock full of locusts and you know, just oaks, and at places you're not even walking on the ground, you're walking
oh,
on
wow.
the vegetation, right?
That's hard.
A few feet off of the ground. It's really slow going.
Yep.
So we were taking a lot of time to go along these east-facing slopes on the way out to Woolsey. But eventually we made it. It's, you know, just sloshing through the brush and keeping your focus on the objective. And we got to Woolsey and hung out there in some limited shade for like an hour. And we had hoped actually to see down onto the Kolb Arch, which is down just below Woolsey
okay.
Butte to the south. We couldn't actually see that, so we would have had to go down to the Red Wall Rim and to get a good view, but we just didn't have the energy to do that.
Yeah.
And, of course, we had to face this return
right.
through all this brush.
Right.
So we started back in the afternoon, and we actually found a better way to avoid some of that brush by staying low, approaching the Coconino slot. And then, fortunately, just as we were starting up the Coconino Gully, Art looked up and saw a deer trail that we had missed on the descent. So we were able to follow that, and that you know, was allowing us to walk on the ground rather than hanging on to aspen shoots and things like that to lower yourself down. Anyways, it went much quicker
nice.
Going back up, and so that was another strenuous day, but another summit. So it was quite satisfying, and again, it was this introduction, or maybe a reintroduction to North Rim camping, car camping, and Grand Canyon hiking. You know, integrating those two recreational pastimes.
Right.
For me, it's just a really deluxe way to go. So. Yeah, so that was, you know, some short hikes that were satisfying. I did do another hike in December
okay.
of 2012, another day hike, And again, this one, we had, once again, we are trying to get a number of summits here in the area around Buddha Temple, right? Manu and Shellback and whatnot. But that was the plan. But this particular trip, Art was feeling sick when I got down to Phoenix. And so, you know, we had to postpone that trip again, once again. And I just wound up taking a day trip myself, and I went down and I hiked down the old Tanner Trail and circumvented Desert View there. So this would have been in December, and I drove up to the to Desert View and parked just south of the park boundary, actually, and then in the morning got up and drove and left my car at the parking lot, hiked down the road towards Cedar Mountain, and then found that that the route at the top of Tanner Canyon, the east arm of Tanner Canyon.
Right.
So this is the route that supposedly the horse thieves would have run cattle up. Now, it's hard to believe that from what I saw of the red wall rim on that that day, the red wall from where I, you know, came down in the east arm of Tanner over to the where the main Tanner Trail is, it's pretty slow going and very rough going, and I didn't see much evidence of any kind of trail building in that area. So I'm a little suspicious that that horse thief route went out the old Tanner Trail, even though there is supposedly some trail construction in there. So it's from my perspective, it's an open story and needs more research. But in any event, I finally was able to, you know, to trace that route out and did that day hike around Desert View coming up the Tanner Trail at the end of the day. And yeah, it was a nice loop to make, and quite, you know, spectacular views, right? So and in particular, like at this point, you know, I had proposed the name Butchered Butte for Butchered Butte, and it had been accepted at this point. And I still marvel, and this hike was one of these opportunities, at how commanding a presence Butchered Butte has on the entire, you know, eastern part of Grand Canyon. And you know, you see it from so many different places. And so I remember thinking, when I was particularly sitting at the top of the red wall here, below the descent from the rim, you know, you could see Butchered Butte. I mean, a lot of other buttes too, but certainly Butchered Butte stands out, and it's high enough that it has a very imposing presence there. So I'm really glad we got to name that, you know, butte for Harvey. I think it's a good testament to his explorations in
and
the canyon.
I'll want to know all about that on one of these interviews.
Okay, well, so we can certainly go into that, because it was a fairly complicated process, for sure.
Yeah, no, I definitely would like to devote an interview to that.
Okay. So that was basically 2012, a series of short, well, actually 2010 too, right? So when they started, a series of short hikes, but still satisfying nonetheless, don't worry, there's more big hikes to come. So we were running out of juice here because we were hitting our 60s or anything.
Right.
Actually, I guess it was 50s.
So just to clarify, this December 2012 hike down the old Tanner Trail to the new Tanner Trail and then up the new Tanner Trail?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when I was younger, I had come up when I climbed Cardenas and Escalante. So this would have been in the 70s. I actually came up there's a really neat route that comes up through the Coconino and Kaibab right up to the Desert View Watchtower.
Right. I've done that.
Yeah.
That's very fun.
Yeah, I've done that a couple times, but I didn't do that on this trip.
So then when you came up the new Tanner, you had to get back to your car over at Desert View.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And I hiked along the rim there. And you know what was from Lipan Point, right? I just hiked the rim. I mean, it's fairly open and whatnot, so it's straightforward. And one of the things, now that you mentioned it, one of the things I remember that was very interesting, particularly around Lipan Point, and some of the Well, when you're about a mile east of Lipan Point, maybe halfway to Desert View, the road comes up very close to the rim,
right?
And so it's, you know, in places you're kind of walking on the road if you're walking along the rim.
Right.
But there's a number of plaques that I noticed that people have mounted there that are in memorial to individuals.
Huh.
And I think what they are is, you know, somebody who loved the Grand Canyon passes away, and, you know, their family or whoever, somebody, a friend, will take, put up this memorial plaque. I don't, you know, they're not, they're, it's not like there's a big sign or anything like that. It's just a plaque on a small cliff of Kaibab or something like that, right? Or on a terrace of exposed slab of Kaibab. And I don't know if people, you know, the ashes are scattered there or whatever, but it was very interesting because like, I ran into like three of them in this afternoon when I was walking back along the rim there, three of these plaques. And you know, I'm assuming that it's kind of illegal to do that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, it's not, I mean, I don't care one way or the other, right? It's not like I'm an angel myself. So, yeah, it was just very interesting to see. Huh. Maybe something to consider for myself. I don't know.
Interesting. Huh.
Yeah, huh. Yeah, so...
That's a nice
that
hike.
It was a fun way to, you know, to end the day, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I had always wanted to do that upper part of the old, you know, to do the old Tanner Trail.
Right.
And to see what that was like.
I've never done
quite
that.
Honestly, I found very little in the way of trail construction. And so it, you know, makes me wonder how extensive that trail ever was. But anyways.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe this is a good place to wrap up this Part 27, and next time we will pick up 2013.
Okay.
Cool.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, with that, we will conclude Part 27, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggard. Today is Sunday, February 6th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin. Jim, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.